Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Nicholas Naclaro, founder of Mmly, the new classic cookie brand offering indulgent snacks that are actually good for you. Mmly's cookies deliver real cookie taste with 3 times the protein, 3 times the fiber, and 40% less sugar than other cookie brands. Launched in 2021, it can be found online, on GoPuff, and on Amazon, and at retailers including Sprouts, The Fresh Market, Erewhon, Foxtrot, and Fresh & Co. Welcome, Nicholas.
Thank you, Allie. Nice to chat with you today.
Nice to chat with you too. I've been seeing these little packages of cookies kind of all over the place. So it's fun. It's fun watching things become ubiquitous, as they say. And so we're going to get into it and hear all about it. But I wanted to go a little bit back. I don't always do this with founders. But I do think that you have a really interesting story. And I know that you were, you know, a pastry chef before and your family has bakeries and you also had this unhappy relationship with food. So maybe just tell me a little bit about you and what happened and kind of what the impetus for the company was.
Yeah, for sure. By the way, I love Haven's Kitchen, and I am just, I need to try the aioli as soon as possible. I'm not in the States right now, but I can't wait to try it.
Yay. Thank you. I'll get you some when you get back.
Cool. I'm from New York. I'm from Westchester, a basic Italian American family upbringing, and food, like so many cultures, is central to just our family's existence. Like everything really comes back to food. And I just, you know, I grew up around it, but I also grew up around parents that, you know, I came from a middle-class family, like working class to an extent family. And they would just go to BJ's and buy whatever was in bulk pack, and and they would buy Sunny D and the delicious chocolate chips from Costco and BJ's, and I was just around food all the time, and I loved it. I also loved cooking. I loved baking at a pretty young age, so I did have a interesting relationship with food when I was younger. I ate a lot of sugar. I was pretty overweight, coping with some school bullying, things that a lot of kids go through. And I turned to food. Food was really like my refuge. It was comfort. It was peace. It was security. It was whatever loved me when I felt like no one else loved me. Right.
Yeah.
But I was baking all the time and cooking. So it was like this duality with food. And thankfully I had a super supportive family that provided like 10 years of therapy that helped me look at food in a new light and really understand it for what it is. And in my teens, I know, I lost a lot of weight. That's really not the most important really component of this. I learned how to eat like really good foods that are really good for you. And I ate foods that were good for me, but I made sure that they actually tasted good.
And still gave you the joy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All the time. And so I decided to go to cooking school actually, and worked on some lines as a line cook, and then moved over to pastry. And I really saw this as like an opportunity to channel what I went through with food into something really beautiful and art form. And I worked in Michelin restaurants and very nice places and made these very cool looking desserts. And I thought it was a challenge to be able to like make sugary foods, to be able to be strong enough to be around these foods. But then I realized like, why am I feeding people sugar? Even though it's beautiful, it doesn't mean it's good for them. And is there a way to make foods that we all love taste really good and actually be good for you? But sort of like secretly good for you to an extent. And for people that want it to be good for you, great. But for most people that just want what they love, like cakes, cookies, aiolis, whatever, just make it delicious and add in some health benefits. So I wanted to start this when I was 20. I didn't have the guts to do it at 20, needed to spend a few years around other entrepreneurs. And at 25, I started working on the formula for this. And it's like the typical story. I spent a year in like on someone's couch in a 400 square foot apartment, creating the recipe, teaching myself shelf life development. We finally got it out into the market. Yeah, it was fun. And my aunt invested, another angel investor, and really just the past 2 to 3 years, like the first year was just iterating on the product. And yeah, I made a cookie brand that's actually delicious and good for you. And I think it's a gift to be able to bring one of the most beloved snacks back with sort of a refresh.
Yeah. I want to ask a little bit about that first year. You know, I think a lot of what we're doing is racing against the clock in a way, right? Like however much we raise, whether it's angels putting in $75,000 or some of these VC backed companies raising $50 million, there's a clock that gets set. And it's like, you got to figure stuff out before you run out of money, or at least you run out of the opportunity to raise more money. And sometimes that's on a smaller scale and sometimes that's on a larger scale. And I was talking to a friend who also is an investor a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, a lot of times he sees these companies who they do figure it out. They just figure it out after they've either raised too much or it's taken a little too long. And he's like, those are the saddest ones, because you know that they've figured that inflection point, but maybe it's just come a little too late. And that's candidly like that's my fear, you know? And, but I guess, you know, what we're all trying to do now is speed up our timeline of figuring it out while at the same time spending less money doing it. And that's sort of the key, I think, with the new climate of less money available, more scrappy, every dollar has to count. So, you know, you're close to it. You know, you're now in what, year four, year three, you're
almost at the end of year three. Yeah. Year
four. Okay. So you're fresh enough with it where you can kind of look back and say, okay, here's what I learned year one. For the people listening that maybe are on a similar trajectory, like what were some of those things that You know, you kind of got to go through it, but maybe you can go through it a little quicker and with a little less money than you did.
Yeah. A lot of learnings in the first 2 years, not just the first year, but the second year too. I would say if you look at our product, right, it was a mainstream, like testing this product out in the market, we've iterated on it 3 times, the recipe and the branding. If I had known what I know now, we create cookies and it's a very mainstream product. But I think one thing that I tried to do in the beginning was the positioning was just not, it didn't have mainstream appeal. And I could have went through that process much quicker to just understand that humans are very simple. They'll right. typically eat what they always eat. And just make sure you have a scalable product and like scalable as in it sells to various consumers, even though you're focusing on a core consumer base, and also position it to, I don't want to say trigger, but to really hit those key points that consumers are really looking for across the board.
So you think, I mean, I guess on the product itself, do you think you were trying to do too much originally, or do you think it just didn't taste as kind of mainstreamy as people wanted? And then separately on the package, were you like too functional and you backed off of that and just leaned more into like, this is just a cookie that happens to be good for you? Like, can you give me an example sort of product and packaging where you kind of mainstreamified it? Because I think this is really relevant for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, like we use in our fruit, they tasted delicious from day one, but like we used monk fruit in our cookies and apples. We just use a very simple apple sweetener in the cookies, and then we added monk fruit to make it sweeter. So we were trying to like something like that sort of tripped over ourselves because not a lot of consumers love monk fruit. And we were just trying to make it. I would say too perfect to an extent, and it was just too complicated. So we took that out. I mean, within 6 months of launching, because we received feedback, and I'd like to say we adapted pretty quickly. And then on the packaging side, like the first iteration, like the first package that came out, it was just so busy. Like we had characters on it. It was very youthful, so it wasn't super attractive to say a millennial or like a millennial consumer. And also what you mentioned was functional. Like I tried to make this product too functional. It actually said functional cookie on the box. And
people might not want a functional cookie, right?
Yeah, like people don't really care. Like it just like supports digestive health and made with fruits and veggies. And it's like for the few consumers that really care about that, they're going to look at the ingredient label and they're going to be smart enough to know something like that. What are consumers really looking for? I mean, it's pretty common across the board, like clean ingredients. It tastes really good. Low in sugar most of the time, but good sugars, right? Which is why we just stick with apples and coconuts. Coconut sugar, and even like the protein and the fiber, like they're nice to have. So I mean, protein is coming into focus now.
It's funny that you're saying this because I don't know if you were able. I don't know if you listened, but I had Anna Whiteman on a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about Expo, and like her big takeaways from Expo, and I keep going back to them because I think it's like. Her takeaways from Expo are sort of like her takeaways on like the current state of CPG, which is that for a while there, we all got into, whether we thought we were or not, we were all in this bubble of you know, even though the consumer isn't necessarily there yet, if we make these products, whether it's a sauce or a cookie or whatever, they will come. And we were sort of, I think, given that impression because there was this this kind of COVID bump, and social media has its thing, and that can be very sort of silo-y. And then there was all this money. But what has happened now in the industry is that we're all realizing we don't need to, as they say, boil the ocean. We don't need to be crazy functional, zero everything, the most whatever. We just need to be like a little bit better for you. And we need to taste really good, which kind of, you know, still matters. People aren't just looking at their macros. And we need to not try to convince the consumer that they need this, but build something for where they're at. And that was like the big sort of aha. Because, you know, I think we're all realizing that. We're all realizing that it's not doing us any favors to be everything. We just need to be a little bit more or less of a couple of things. And then the messaging needs to be, I think you're right, as simple as possible. I mean, even with us, you know, I don't think we're totally there yet, but people still are confused by dip, drizzle, dunk. Like, to me, that couldn't be clearer. But they want to know, dip what? Drizzle onto what? Dunk what? Like, they really want to be told. And I'm still sort of like, why? But that's, you're right. I mean, they don't want to have to spend the time figuring it out. I think that's.
No, it's just, it's most people. I mean, people, when I go into a store, I honestly, as a consumer, if I just walk in and I buy things that are easy, especially in the United States, things that are easy and familiar and things that I don't really have to think about. Those are the things that I'll purchase again and again. And I totally agree with you and Anna. I didn't listen to the episode, but the days of, I mean, cash was just flowing and consumer companies were treated really like, this is what I've heard. And I'm sort of thinking this is true. Like tech companies just grow. No efficiencies. You can run cash flow negative for years while you're figuring things out.
You don't need product market fit if you can just keep growing and finding more people to sell to cheap. You know, that's the thing.
Like how many people can you sell broccoli shots to?
Right.
I don't know. I really don't know. But I mean, we don't need that many products.
Right.
As sad as that is, it's like we all have really great ideas. But it's going, the question that you asked before, which is how do we burn the least amount of cash possible? And at the same time, you're dealing with this time crunch because time is really of the essence in capturing consumers. I think it really does come down to like, you need to be well capitalized. And if you don't, then it's really important to recognize what I've learned over the past couple of years, which is food brands and consumer brands. They, if you don't have enough cash, you just need to grow really efficiently over a longer period of time. And ask yourself if you're committed to that. And, you know, be really clear with what investors you're bringing on too.
Yep.
And if you're committed to that and you bring on investors that are, you know, there with you, and you have something that has, you know, this mass appeal and you can adapt really quickly, then great. I'm not sure everybody is really on board with like the 10 to 15 year, 10 to 20 year horizon that a lot of these companies have to see like real measurable success.
Yeah.
Unless you have $25 million.
Right.
And even, I mean, you know, even if people are like, yeah, 10 or 15 years, that sounds fine. What I don't think they necessarily realize, when certainly what I didn't realize, is like growing efficiently over a long period of time means not doing a lot of the fun stuff, not building a team necessarily, right? No. Not being able to build a brand particularly well, not having, you know, people help you figure out a lot of the stuff. Building, it's more of a, and I think a lot of people, myself included, part of what keeps us in this business is the fun of building a team and doing marketing and, you know, designing brand things. And that's the stuff that doesn't happen when you're a team of two and you're just trying to make a product, you know, profitably. So it's not even just like the time commitment. It's almost like the lifestyle that you're going to have for the next several years. It's not the fun stuff, you know, unless you really enjoy the other stuff, which a lot of founders maybe do, but not that many that I know. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and we're going to talk about capital efficiency and we're going to talk about funding and what you're up to, because it's cool. We'll be right back.
Cool.
I'm back with Nicholas Naclero, founder of Mly. Okay, so I want to talk about your WeFunder campaign. I know that there's a little bit of a time crunch on that. I went to the page. It looks amazing, by the way. Everyone, y'all tell people where to go. You know, first of all, congrats on all of the achievements, but even just the way that you put the information on there. It's like, you know, I'm like, yeah, totally. Yes. This, you know, like it was great. So obviously I want to talk about, you know, why you decided to go with crowdfunding, what you've learned from the process, anything that you can sort of give to people thinking about that option, you know, a couple takeaways, and then we'll get into the meat of it.
Yeah. So yeah, we are raising on WeFunder. We chose WeFunder, by the way. I mean, anyone can invest. I think one of the gifts, which I can share about this, is that we're not just bringing on accredited investors. Like, anyone that believes in a mission or a product that they love can invest $100 in a company. And that's like the same as going out for lunch in New York City. And you can check out the WeFunder page. It's wefunder.com/MMLY MMMLY, and we're closing into the next 2 weeks. But it's been, I mean, it's been an awesome run. Like, we, you know, we've brought on some great people over the past couple of years, like the CFO of Oatly, Siggy from Siggy's Yogurt. We even brought on, I don't know how this happened, but a presidential candidate. It's just cool. It's cool to bring a community together. And I think, one, we chose WeFunder because we just reviewed WeFunder, Start Engine, and Republic, and it just really seemed like the best platform with the most traction and the most volume and the most receptive team within WeFunder. We also, you know, chose this campaign to do a crowdfunding campaign because it's really like free marketing to an extent. I mean, a lot of these campaigns are numbers games. Like, we have 154 investors right now, and they are like our brand advocates, and we're going to leverage that as much as we can once the campaign closes.
Right.
I mean, and to be honest with you, since this is really important information for founders too, I mean, bringing on angel investors right now, money is still tight and people are not investing or just throwing 10, 25, 50K, 100K checks anymore. I mean, they want to see really solid financials and solid businesses. So we're turning to our community to help build this. And you know, what to learn from this campaign, which is the, what's involved in it. It really is a marketing project. It requires extensive communications, pre-campaign with email flows, having a lot of leads between customers, investors, and a strong network to reach out to. And it requires, I would say, we put in like two to three weeks ahead of the campaign. We mobilized pretty quickly, but we had a lot of brand materials ready to go. And it requires a lot of outreach because, again, it's a numbers game. Like, you need to get 400 people to put in 100 to 5 grand. But it's a good opportunity for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't mind, I'd love to understand. I mean, you're gaining distribution. Your margins are, you know, in solid shape from what I saw, and getting even better. You know, you've figured out some stuff. There seems to be, you know, market, you know, sort of white space. What did you hear? Did you go to early stage investors? And what did you hear a common refrain other than we're just not investing right now? Like, what was the thing that you're trying? What did you hear that like is like, you're like, okay, now I'm going to solve that? Because I kept hearing it.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, it was four things come to mind. One is a lot of investors are saying they're not investing right now, especially angel investors.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of investors are also not investing in consumer. Because they're not investing in consumer when they're looking at financials, after they review financials and what how much cash it takes to build a business.
Yeah, and how long.
A lot of them... Yeah, and how long? And a lot of them that I've met have been burnt by consumer good companies over the past couple of years. The other two objections, like, our margins guaranteed to be 45 to 50% once we ramp up to a certain level, but they're not amazing right now because we're not at scale and we haven't been able to, until we raise this money and we launch more distribution, we won't see the 30% efficiency. So we need to raise this to be able to see that efficiency. And a lot of them always want to wait until when the grass has grown, they want to be there for that. And a lot of people in other facets of life, they just, they want to be there when things are better.
It's too risky, I guess. It's, you know, I remember at the beginning of the year I wrote, so when we were selling our aiolis in, you know, we were trying to get them, you know, before our first production run, I obviously wanted to have like commitments from retailers. I needed to have customers, obviously, before I made it. And one really, you know, wonderful retailer that we have a nice relationship with on our fresh, the condiment buyer basically called me and was like, we know that you're a great, you know, partner. We love the brand. We like what you're doing. I tasted it. It tastes fantastic. But without a shelf-ready pouch, like what we sent to our buyers were, you know, clear pouches with a label on them to make it look like what it would eventually look like. But we're like, this is not final shelf-ready packaging. And she just was like, I can't take the risk until I see that. Like, I like it. I like you. I think it's a when, not an if, but I can't give you, you know, shelf space in this reset. Because I just simply can't take the risk. And it was like such a kind of moment for me because I was like, how, I didn't really see it as risky. I was like, this is exactly what the product is going to taste like. We've made you an exact mock-up. But to her, it was like, how's it going to be in my refrigerator after I open it and use it for a couple of days? You know, what's it going to, you know, look like? Like, she had questions that she could not answer. And we had a really candid conversation about it, which, you know, I really appreciated, because a few years ago, that would not have been the case. But because there are fewer resets, and because the dollars are tighter, and because the whole ecosystem is sort of under pressure, they're just not going to take risks. Will that loosen up again? Absolutely, because everything's cyclical. But I feel like more and more our jobs as founders is, you know, investors don't want to risk, customers don't want to risk, consumers don't want to risk. Going back to your thing about messaging, the last thing a person buying food in a grocery store wants to do is buy something that they don't know what to do with and don't eat. It's like our job as founders is to take the risk out for all of the stakeholders until things loosen up again. But the good news is that taking that risk out is always a good exercise for us, even when the cycle turns back around and people are, you know, spending and investing and, you know, loosened up. But I think this is a really good point. And, you know, you're right. The problem for us is that there are not that many. There are a lot of early stage tech investors. There are not a lot of early stage CPG investors. And there were what they call like these tourist investors, right? There were a lot of angels, but they have since sort of moved on. So there are not that many funds even who do, you know, 1 to 5 million in, you know, last 12 months of sales. And they're just few and far between.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but there's, no matter what environment we're in or what we're experiencing in terms of cash flow and the ability to capitalize a company, having everything wrapped up and figured out to the best of your ability with the resources that you have. I mean, margins, set up pre-existing contracts with your manufacturers.
Yep.
Just having the numbers right, having the product, having one product that is actually really good. And I mean, it's really interesting that, I mean, you worked with this person before, right?
Well, no, I didn't work with her because we're in a different category at the grocery store. So this was, you know, our fresh sauce.
It was a proven brand within that store, though.
Proven brand. Yep.
It's like you have that baseline trust.
But, you know, again, she and I think the reason why we even were able to have the conversation, and by the way, we still were not probably going on those shelves for at least another year. You know, because I'm always like, is there an opportunity for this? And can we do that? And maybe you can try this. And probably not. You know, but I still very much appreciate the relationship, obviously. And I appreciate the fact that she got on a call. And I mean, after giving us a no, which I was pretty surprised by, was able to have a conversation that I thought was really helpful and productive. But that's just that's the circumstance we're in right now. And I think once we all sort of like wrap our heads around it, we've adjusted our frame as like, okay, I need to minimize risk for everyone else in the playing field with me. How do I do it? What can I do ahead of time to take any sort of doubt or risk out of these people's minds? And I think what you're saying about investors is like, it's going to be hard to get there. You're going to have a hard time making a product with 80%, you know, product margin, either that's truly better for you, because you could do it with sugar and salt and, you know, fat. But it's going to be hard, or without, you know, some real scale. And we all know that scale doesn't necessarily solve everything. But no, going back to your, you know, your sort of route to market, you are in a bunch of stores, you're going into a bunch of stores, but you also have, you know, this little, I don't know if we, if it's kind of food service or if we, what we call it, but you also have that, like the juice bars and the coffee shops and maybe not necessarily, you know, the big grocery stores with the slotting, but the places where you can kind of build that awareness, get yourself out there. And also they are buying cookies. Tell me a little bit if that was sort of coincidence, how you thought about that, if it is actually a good channel, you know, if you're, if you like it or.
So, I mean, we're venturing into that now, food service. I learned by failure within the first 2 years. There are accounts that we're in right now. There are also accounts that want to take the brand national, and we'll likely say no to them because when we look at a 12-month P&L, and when I've had conversations with other founders that have put the same brand into that store and told me what they invested in that store, it just doesn't make sense with certain things. So we're being really, really choosy. And I'm even speaking with these other founders, we're just being choosy and cautious about what retail we open. Because I'm seeing them pull back on marketing spend, and these retailers are just kicking them out of the accounts, even though they've been there for three years. So really what we're asking ourselves is, one, what needs the least amount of marketing dollars to actually drive a machine? Does it need any? Because if we go into Microsoft or Amazon corporate offices, that's just a volume play. Like margins are the margins. The markup is the markup. They're just buying cookies. We don't need to promo everything and buy into all of these marketing programs.
Yeah.
What will go direct? I mean, that's a little bit less likely to happen, but like with Juice Press and some of these juice accounts and fast casual accounts, we go direct and it makes sense. And if we do go through a distributor, I mean, I'm taking advantage of the minority, the minority, but also the new emerging brand, like applying to competitions, but also being really strict about the contracts that we're signing and what we're committing to opening too. Like, and just looking at every single charge and estimating every single charge that we'll see. Can we spread out if we're opening up four distribution points of distribution? Can they agree to, which we've actually seen success with, can they charge that over a year so that we're not seeing horrible trade spend over one quarter of the year, because that hurts investment. And honestly, a lot of this is, it goes back to what we spoke about before, which is there are just longer cycles for everything. They're just longer cycles. Like, if you really want to get into the right accounts, you're going to have to say no a lot, and you're going to have to wait. And it might mean building the brand with two people, and you're growing a lot less quickly than you would have thought you would have been growing. And maybe you're working a consulting job. Like that's what it looks like.
Yeah, I think I agree. And that is the part, you know, because I think it goes back to when you say, okay, this is going to take a long time and you're going to grow less exponentially. And, you know, people are like, okay, that's fine. But when you say, and you're going to be doing it with one other person, maybe who's part-time, and you're also not going to be able to do any of the stuff that you see that looks like why you're attracted to this in the first place, you know? It definitely does sort of take away. But I do like the what needs the least amount of money to grow. And, you know, that's why I think probably every third episode I talk about velocity because even I'm literally sitting here staring at our pipeline right now. And, you know, yeah, we've already paid to get on the shelf, whether it's a free fill or slotting or paid for the spot, you know, at the DC, you've already paid. And once you've paid, the more that you can get from that spot, the better. That's where your best sales dollars are. And now, 100%. Of course, I'm thinking like, who wants an aioli in a pouch in a office cafeteria? Because I feel like now I got to go after that.
Yeah.
I want to hear a little bit more before we go. You know, obviously this is not an investment. I feel like I have to do that thing where they do it, where like, we're not investment professionals and this isn't professional investment advice, but I would like, you know, you to make your pitch, to anyone listening. You know, there are a couple thousand people a week listening. So I don't know, maybe some of them invest. I have no idea. And like you said, it's only, you know, you don't have to make a big one, but if, you know, can you just make your little pitch as compelling as possible quickly, for anyone who's thinking about it or who wants to be supportive and why?
Yeah. Thanks for that opportunity. I mean, if you're someone that loves food, loves delicious food, namely cookies, and you see that there is an opportunity in the industry, which cookies is a $12 billion category, to really create something like similar to an Olipop or a Poppy in the cookie category, which is exactly what we're doing, you can support, you know, a brand that is defining what the next generation of classic mainstream snacks can look like. They can taste delicious and they can actually be good for you. And people can access those foods and really enjoy and love what they eat. So if you want to invest in Umli, invest on WeFunder. Minimum is $100. WeFunder.com/Mmly, MMMLY. And we'd love to have you. We have amazing investors. Check out the page. And we're changing food and it's a gift.
Awesome. And the page again, even if you're not going to invest, it's like a masterclass and like a really well, you know, you've got the brand there, you've got the business there, you've got the, you know, sales, you've got the marketing, you've got the ops, you've got it all sort of like really nicely laid out for folks to go take a look at.
Yeah. If anyone needs help, let me know.
Amazing. Nicholas, thank you. Thanks for making time from Italy. And it's nice to meet you after all this time. We have a lot of mutual friends and it is really fun watching you grow. So I'm wishing you all the absolute best and I hope you crush this WeFunder.
Same here, Ellie. Here to support you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Armin, thank you for stepping in today. As always, it's so fun seeing you and talking to you and the power that makes this whole thing happen. So appreciate it. And listeners, next week is all about Amazon and lots of questions. You know, we just launched the aioli there and there's, you know, DSPs and PPCs. There's so many acronyms and there's all these people freaking out about Seller Central and third party things and yada, yada, yada. And so I want to work it out. And so next week I have an amazing guest coming on. We'll talk all about Amazon and I will be back with another episode of In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.